Good morning. Welcome to our meeting. It's 9 a.m. on November 4th, 2025. Time to convene a regular meeting with the Snohomish County PUD Board of Commissioners. I'm Sid Logan, President of Nitton. Joining me today are Commissioner Tony Olson, Commissioner Julieta Alfa-Crosby, Jason Sikowski, our Chief Energy Resource Officer, Colin Willenbrock, our Chief Operating and Legal Officer, Allison Morrison, Clerk of the Board, Jenny Rich, Deputy Clerk of the Board, and Morgan Stolzner, Deputy Clerk of the Board. Please mute or turn off your cell phones or electronic devices at this time. So to begin with, I will start with a flag salute. You may join me if you would like.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Copies of the agenda are located on the deputy clerk's table near the entrance. Commissioners, are there any items to be added or changes to be made to the published agenda?
Yes, we need to add a lot of items there. So as add item 030.00, places CEO, General Manager Designation Authority, add item 030.01, at places Emergency Declaration Jackson Oil Spill, at item 0AC.00, at places Covership Consideration of a Resolution authorizing the Chief Executive Officer General Manager of Public Utility District Number 1 of Snohomish County to execute a settlement agreement regarding certain litigations with Inertia Engineering and Machine Works, Inc., Stevens McCarthy Lancaster LLC, and Wasco Distributions, Inc. At item 0AC.01, at places resolution consideration of a resolution authorizing the Chief Executive Officer, General Manager of Public Utility District Number 1 of Snohomish County to execute a settlement agreement regarding certain litigations with Inertia Engineering and Machine Works, NC, Stephens McCarthy Lancaster LLC, and Wasco Distributions, EMC. At item 0AC.02, at places attachment number 1, consideration of a resolution authorizing the Chief Executive Officer General Manager of Public Utility District Number 1 of Snohomish County to execute a settlement agreement regarding certain litigations with Inertia Engineering and Machine Works, ENC, Stephens, McCarthy, Lancaster LLC, and Wasco Distributions, EMC. At item 0AC.03, at places amendment the attachment number 1. And at item 0AC.04, at places second amendment attachment number 1. Thank you.
Thank you. I feel like I should offer you a bottle of water. Comment from the public is item 2 on today's agenda, and that's when the board will hear comments for items that are not listed on today's agenda. Comments will be limited to 5 minutes, and persons shall be recognized to speak with sign-up cards located on the deputy clerk's table near the entrance. If joining by Zoom, click raise hand or dial *9 if by phone. I will call on you to speak at the appropriate time. If you're calling in on Zoom, you'll need to dial *6 on your phone to mute or unmute. This meeting is being recorded. When addressing the board during the meeting, please step up to the podium, use the microphone, state and spell your name, and address the commissioners, not the audience. If you have documents or other materials standard in the record, hand them to the deputy clerk, please, who will distribute them to the board. We appreciate your cooperation with our speakers. Please note that all motions receive an automatic silent second from the board. This ensures that all issues can be brought to the floor for discussion. First item, agenda 1, recognition declarations. 1A, employee of the month for October, Emily Perry. We have Jeannie Hurd-Harshberger here to introduce Emily. I listed your name, sorry.
No worries. Good morning, commissioners. I am Jeannie Hurd-Harshberger from System Planning and Protection, and it is my pleasure to introduce you to our November employee of the month, Emily Perry. Emily is a transmission planner in the System Planning and Protection Group, whose influence is felt widely throughout the district. When she first hired on 2.5 years ago, I emphasized the importance of having a transmission planner who owns the care and feeding of the electric transmission system, and she has taken that to new heights. In addition to the NERC compliance work that most transmission planners are known for, she's done studies to determine when projects must be put in service. She's dug in to understand the impact and the need for capital projects so they can be prioritized for construction. And she created a system to make that visible. To convey the effects of delaying or not funding projects, Emily borrowed from the toolkit of our enterprise risk management team to develop a means of quantifying risks, impacts, and probabilities of various outcomes so that senior leadership is much better informed about the outcomes of spending our customer owners' money. She's also developed analytics to enable real-time, on-the-fly scenarios of different budget funding levels. That alone, in my opinion, led to fewer large meetings to settle on budget levels for the next 5 years, making, again, best use of customers' funds. Emily's not deterred by setbacks. She turned a lack of seating in our work group area to an advantage when she got a desk in the substation engineering space. Through both her willing engagement and her propensity for bringing in baked goods, she strengthened the bonds of collaboration with this important partner in capital projects. One prime example is the change of site for a new substation, which improves outcomes not only for the district, but also for our customers. And when working long hours during last year's bomb cyclone restoration efforts, Emily met people from work groups across the district, expanding both her network and the visibility of the work that we do in planning and protection. Emily is a natural teacher, and she comes by it honestly. She can convey complex concepts in a very understandable way, from designing make and take projects for middle school and high school girls at a STEM fair, to explaining the necessity of a new 115 kV line through downtown Everett, or working at the PUD booth at the fair. Emily engages with people in ways that represent the district in its best light. As chair of the Engineering Safety Committee, Emily has increased both in-person attendance and engagement during the meetings this past year. First, she engaged stakeholders to create time and space to gather around some sort of food before the meeting started. You know, that will entice engineers to show up. Adding on to that, the meeting content has been thought-provoking and extremely relevant. So not many engineers use dinosaurs for illustrations, but Emily researched inherently safe designs for a recent safety meeting, presented the principles, then had to run through some scenarios for a design that, if they missed the mark, would lead to the extinction of said dinosaurs. It not only created a lot of engagement, it made the teaching memorable. Emily sees a need and finds a way to fill it. When building contingency lists for system assessments caused long delays in starting the analysis, she capitalized on the skills of our summer student to create a script to automatically generate the list for cases years in the future. This was a brilliant innovation that will pay off in more efficient workflows, less drudgery, and time to pursue higher value work. Emily brings curiosity, willingness to work hard, and humility to every situation and gets great results from the group. She gathers people to collaborate on big projects and was instrumental in the update of our transmission general planning guidelines last year. This year, she's gathering stakeholders to update our and streamline our interconnection processes. Who can make reading standards sound like fun? Well, when it's presented as a book club, even with reading assignments, people show up and participate. Emily asks great, thought-provoking questions, and I'm confident that great learning and an improved process is going to result. These are the few of the reasons that Emily was selected as our Employee of the Month, and I think you can see why this distinction is so fitting.
Come up, Emily.
Oh, it's this one.
You're right up my alley. I so enjoyed the write-up.
Oh, thank you, Jeannie.
Well, well deserved, I know, but wow. You're speaking my language, honey. Go ahead.
Well, I just want to say thank you so much. The write-up is phenomenal, but what the material they had to write about sounds even more phenomenal. An engineer who's a great communicator is really the best kind of engineering. And I appreciate that you not only can communicate with your fellow engineers and others, but you also sound like you're a great communicator with the public, which really helps us a lot for our customers to understand what we do and why we do.
Are you age three?
And baking never hurts, so.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to see that.
Yeah. And I would like to thank you so much for all that you do, and mostly connecting with people and create engagement. That synergy is really important, and meet the people where they are in the grassroots. And also curiosity. You bring curiosity. Being curious is one of my favorite words. You know why? Because you have to be curious in order to discover a lot of stuff there. So thank you for all that you bring.
My pleasure.
Well, my dear, you're a saint. Working with the capital program and the capital budget. I did so go. And I enjoyed listening to your narrative, and because she has all of the skills that I never had.
Really?
That I never had. I would get in those, you know, like by meeting number five, I was so upset, starting with a P, that, you know, it was a nightmare for me, but it sounds like you got it down to a science and get lots of cooperation, which is important, and working with people that are really passionate about what they're bringing to the table. And it's a really tough call in terms of trying to get everyone to understand and help everyone prioritize. At some point, your program or your piece of equipment or whatever is going to make it to the top of the list, but you know, not this year. And that's a hard thing to do. Baked goods. I wish I'd have thought of that. I brought fruit. That's probably why I didn't get very far. How late at night do you have to work after those sessions?
Not very. I work with incredible people, so they make it pretty straightforward.
No midnight.
No.
Okay. Well, I'm just so impressed. I really am. And I know many of you in the audience know how hard that capital, well, the budget in general is, but how hard that capital budget is to put together. Because it's not only you're looking at this year, you're looking out many years. So I'm very impressed with you.
We have some gifts for you, Commissioner. Do you want to hear us out?
I want to say food. I try many people. So maybe next time we can bring tamales or crispy tacos.
Oh, I thought I got
that. I got this for you, Emily.
Oh, thank you.
Should have another zero on it.
Yes. They put it there.
And I get, oh, wow. Isn't it great?
Oh, I thank you.
My best friend took it last month. She did a great job.
That's a beautiful answer.
Thank you.
Well, and I have a trophy. So if you don't have a trophy case, you're going to need to start one.
Thank you.
Is that a different design now?
Yes. I like it.
Is it different? I like it. It's very.
If I can take the documents, let's get some pictures of you with your trophy. We have a picture taker.
Did you know you were going to use the capital budget when you were hired?
No, it was a fun surprise.
Yeah, they don't tell you that when you interview.
You seem to such a positive attitude. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I do have family here. Okay, this is my family. This is my mom, Sarah, and my dad, John, and my sister, Natalie. And 60% of my success is definitely all them. So.
Yeah, you guys get a picture. Maybe Christmas card material.
Oh, yeah.
All right, thank you.
All right, thank you. We'll say for the record, Commissioner, that fruit is a solid silver level. Baked goods are a gold level, but you could have gone with bronze. That's only been a vegetable.
Yeah, I've had a lot of hungry diets at that time. So. But it didn't work.
Next is item two, comments from the public. Are there any comments from the public on items not on today's agenda? Your first and last name for the record and where you are from. Please raise your hand. I don't see any in the room, but we do have a person online whose last digits of their phone is 6578. Good morning. Are you unmuted?
Allowing me to mark or yourself.
We have a phone number starting with 425. Ending in 6578, you've got your hand raised in the meeting. Would you like to speak?
Hello. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Good morning.
Okay. Good morning, Commissioners.
And where are you from?
I'm Erica Madsen. Erica with a C, Madsen, M-A-D-S-E-N, from Arlington. The clerk confirmed on October 31st that each commissioner received my one-page handout. Today, I will prove six violations that demand one solution, restore my analog meter. Number one, timeline violation. PUD's website says customers cannot opt out until they receive notice. I received a PUD letter dated July 14th, 2025, notifying me of installation in 3 to 4 months, yet my meter was installed sometime between August 18th and 20th, less than 6 weeks later, while my family was out of town. In emails, a customer service rep claimed that some customers got meters within 1 week of notice, insisting this fits 3 to 4 months. That's false. Public records show Paul McMurray, senior counsel, wrote to others, the district, quote, the district will send written notices 3 to 4 months in advance of new meter installation, end quote. Number two, trespass via locked gate. PUD entered through locked gate, public records request S000238-082525. Confirms no easement exists. That's trespass under RCW 9A-52.070. Number three, inconsistent opt-out policy. PUD allows non-transmitting opt-out, but only after notice. I was denied the minimum 3 month period to opt-out before installation. By the time I applied, I'd been monitored for weeks. Public records show other customers received McMurray's promise of notice 3 to 4 months before installation. I did not. In an August 28th letter, McMurray told me under 6 weeks is within 3 to 4 months. That's unequal treatment under RCW 54.16.030. Number four, privacy invasion. PUD's opt-out form, it admits meters collect near real-time usage data without consent. Spokesperson Aaron Swaney told the Everett Herald, no personal information, including name, address, account number, will be stored in the meter, but availability of customer login links detailed meter usage to names, addresses, online, creating a cybersecurity portal. That violates RCW 9.73.030, Washington's Privacy Act. Number five, fire hazard. Overheating alert is a reactive band-aid. Stockton, California, 2014, census smart meters, the same as PUDs, exploded from surges displacing families. Reno, Nevada, 2014, a smart meter surge ignited a fatal house fire. My meter is feet from a propane tank, one spark from catastrophe. PUD's Connect Up flyer claims meters are safe with an overheating alert, but the alert is not prevention. It's a reactive band-aid. It only works via RF. Anyone who opts out has no alert, no protection. Analog meters don't explode. Number six, DRIP provides pricing, proves pricing, not safety. PUD's 2023 DRIP blueprint, demand response implementation plan, a 24-page internal plan outlines implementing time of use pricing and cutting 5.6 megawatt peak load by 2025. Smart meters are integral to this plan. Safety is not mentioned as the driver. I have a one-page summary I'm happy to provide. The Attorney General is monitoring patterns, file number 701185. I've acted in good faith and applied for opt-out October 23rd, but demand reinstatement of my analog meter to resolve trespass, privacy violation, fire hazard, unequal notice and treatment. Please direct staff to remove the smart meter, waive all fees, and restore my analog meter. Thank you.
Thank you. No other hands up. We'll move on to item three, our consent agenda, as amended. 3A, approval of the minutes for the regular meeting of October 21st, 2025. 3B, bid awards, professional service contracts, and amendments. 3C, consideration of certification slash ratification and approval of district checks and vouchers. And 3D, emergency declaration. I'll call for a motion.
I move approval.
Are there any comments from the public regarding the consent agenda? Please raise your hand. I'm not seeing any hands up. Are there any questions or comments, commissioners, about the consent agenda?
I have no questions.
I will call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes unanimously. Next, we have our CEO General Manager briefing and study session. This item is for the board and the CEO General Manager, or Dave Looney, to discuss issues among ourselves and with staff. We have Chief Resource Officer Jason Zukowski, who will facilitate this discussion. Good morning, Jason.
All right. Good morning. Thank you very much. We'll jump right into it as we have a pretty full agenda here this morning. And first up, we have Aaron Swaney with the media updates.
Good morning, commissioners. Aaron Swaney, Manager Communications and Marketing, here with the media report. So it's been an exciting last month with some storm coverage for us. Good opportunity to talk to our customers about storm preparation, outage preparation, getting out in front of all that messaging. Did some TV work, radio work on that as we had a couple storms blowing last couple weekends. Boy, it seems like it's a weekend when the storms blow in. But again, yeah, just a great opportunity to talk about really some new improvements to our outage map. Put out a press release on that, and just really the team did a fantastic job really updating the map, making it easier for customers to kind of drill down to their individual outage, get more information, looks better, easier to navigate. So that was really nice to be able to talk to customers about that. And then also Proactive text messages. We've been really, really talking to customers about that and getting that out front, encouraging them to sign up so that when they do lose power, they'll get a text message right to their phone. So that's a bonus that we're really trying to focus on as well.
And Aaron, is it still they sign up for each storm?
They can, but what we're really trying to promote is through My Snowpod, they can actually now sign up for proactive text alerts. So if they go into that alerts field, they can actually put their, they can put their phone number in and save that, and then they'll get text messages as soon as they lose power. So they don't have to go out, go and sign up. So,
The text message, they receive, they are only in English, or we utilize other languages as well for our community that.
That's a good question. I'm not sure on that. Okay. I mean, I think so. There might be a way for that to go multilingual. Yeah, I'll find out.
Okay, thank you.
We also had the Herald column was also about outage prep, and our wire was completely focused on outage preparation for customers.
We had an outage South Camp Carpool quite a few out.
Yeah, this past weekend?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
I thought that. Our generation and natural resources team won an outstanding Stewards of America's Waterway Award from National Hydropower Association. So really kudos for them. We put out a press release on this, got some nice pub for them. They did some work on a hydrologic model to help with water levels of SPADA. So really kudos to them. Just some other coverage kind of in the... Lately, we had a My Edmonds news story actually went out to one of our trade-up events, talked with Julie Mainstone and Dylan Song about kind of our apprentice programs, kind of all the work that we do in the community to talk to high schoolers and college students about the work in the trades. So that was a really nice story. The Herald did a really good story on the study on pink salmon that we were part of. It was actually a UW study, but Andrew McDonald, Larry Lowe took part and helped out with the study, and a lot of the data was collected from Soul River, so a very interesting piece on that. And then IPPA had a cohort of utilities come together we were part of. They did a story on that. There's some resources around wildfire came out of that, and so just this was the first year of that, and I think there's some utilities that are part of the second year, so more to come. And then just wanted to let everybody know that Current will be in mailboxes this week. Focus is on what the utility might look like in 100 years. So just got to sit down with a lot of different groups across the utility and kind of brainstorm some really fun and exciting ways that, you know, what the PUD and what electric utilities, water utilities will be doing in 2049. And there's also information on Water's anniversary. With your community events, Tree Power Program, and the Community Energy Fund, and eventual run in October. And before I go, any questions? I just wanted to bring up Erica Keene. Erica Keene is coming to us from the Forest Service. She's our new PR media liaison. So I wanted to bring up Erica and introduce her to the commission. Yeah, Erica comes to us from the Forest Service, so you'll be seeing her name a lot more than mine, which thank goodness for that. So,
what is her job?
She's a PR media liaison, so kind of taking over from what I did before.
Morning, it's nice to meet you all. I just finished my first month here, and I'm really enjoying it so far. I'm told I'm on the best team at Team PUD, and I would agree so far. They look
well. Welcome.
Thank you.
You know, you'd be working with squirrels. part of the entire school.
A lot of work.
I'll get there.
Welcome.
Thank you.
All right. Any questions on the report?
No.
All right. That's All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Aaron, and welcome, Erica. All right. Up next, we have Shauna Bowser, who's going to give us an update on the federal government shutdown in support.
Good morning, commissioners. Shauna Bowser, Senior Manager of Customer Service. So I'm going to give an update on what we in customer service are doing to help customers. And I got an email that I'm just going to share that we got from our groups in government affairs, just in general, but don't ask me any questions about that because I don't know more details. overall, for our customers, we know that our customers are struggling. So we are allowing arrangements on their invoices. So if the customer calls us, just like in normal day business, we work with the customer to set up payment arrangements, combo or budget payment plans to keep their services on. We also, for those that are impacted directly by the government shutdown, if they are not receiving current payment, then we are following our discount program, which is in our process under seasonal workers. We did the same thing, if you recall, with the Boeing strike. So if a customer calls and some attests that they are a government employee and therefore not getting a paycheck currently, then they can fill out our discount application and write a letter with that claiming that they are a government worker and not getting current payment. And based on their household income and size of household, if they're approved for our discount program at either our 25% or our 50%, they will be approved for a 3-month discount. So it's kind of a temporary thing to assist them in at this time. If we're not in 3 months, we're still in the same situation, then they could apply again, but it will automatically end after 3 months. Similarly, if the shutdown ends, that discount will still remain for that 3 months to help them stay back on. We won't go in and stop it early. The information that I got from government affairs is that the Trump administration announced that it will release half of November's SNAP benefits after a federal court order. But then this morning, there was an announcement that the benefits will be paid, but not until the shutdown ends. So it is an ever-changing information. So we will continue to monitor that and assist our customers to the best of our ability to get them through this.
Any questions? I have a question regarding the 3 months application, because I receive a few phone calls for a few people, Latino community. And the question is, what do they need? They need, if the students they are in reduced lunch program, do they have to bring a proof for that from the school, or do they have to go direct to the city? It's whatever city they are, because city of Lingua, they have discounts for water or utilities too as well. So they're quite confused if they apply there, and they can apply here too as well. So I don't know. I have no answers for that.
Yeah, so each program is different. So if they have, say, City of Lynnwood Water, I'm not sure what their discount program is, but I would encourage them to apply through them. With us, we need their recent income verification. So it'd be the last month's income verification, whether it be pay stubs. Like I said, for this instance, if you're a government worker, it would just be a letter saying that you work for, and there's nothing to provide if you're not getting a paycheck. And then for those that are on school lunch programs, they should have a letter claiming that, and they can include that in the information. We are linked with the school lunch program that auto feeds into our system that will auto approve them. So they could apply that way, either directly with us, or if they're already on the school lunch program, then our system connects with that, and we're happy to discuss. You know, they can call customer service and we can review that with them.
Okay, thank you. Is the auto school lunch program linked to SNAP?
I don't know.
I have no idea.
But for those,
to be linked, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't believe that it's directly linked. Okay. But yeah.
Other questions?
No.
Thank you. It's wonderful that we can turn on a dime and help people.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Shauna. All right. Up next, we have Clark Langstrat. He's provide an update on your local purchasing agreements and federal.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Clark Langstrat, manager of contracts purchasing. I'm here today to update you on an effort that we're
starting to streamline how we approve interlocal agreements and shared contracts with other agencies and with the federal government. We can find that this out here. Here we go. Currently, these interlocal agreements come to you for approval before we can execute them. However, they are at no cost at the time that we use those contracts under those interlocal agreements. Then we would come to you for approval of those individual contracts. So benefits of sharing those contracts, we get lower prices. If we go out to bid for Ford pickups with local Ford dealers, we're not going to get the price that the state of Washington would get. So we use a state of Washington contract. We get much better pricing. It's linked directly to Ford's fleet program. We buy bulk fuel, computer hardware, and software. In fact, I was hoping that they would coincide, but they didn't. The last meeting had three interlocal agreements that you approved, and they were for iPads and some computer hardware and software. So that's a really good example. Another example is all the office supplies we buy are on one or more interlocal contracts. Doing that not only saves money, but it saves time when versus going out to bid for ourselves, and then a shorter cycle time to get those items in the hands of the people that need them. Types of contracts, I mentioned Washington State contracts. We also have contracts with agencies like City of Everett, Snohomish County, Port of Everett. There are larger purchasing cooperatives that we can also use. Government agencies, other states market their cooperatives to agencies all over the country. Prices, again, are come down because of the economies of scale, all of that. Those contracts that we use have to meet Washington statutory requirements, statute referenced in the resolutions for that. So currently, as I said, they're approved by commission before they're signed. What we're asking in the resolutions that will be brought before you is that that signature authority be delegated to the CEO, GM, or designee. We also found when we researched this with legal that we were inconsistent in how they'd been approved in the past. So we're asking in the resolution that you ratify previous ones that may not have come before you. As I stated in the beginning, there's no cost associated with these purchasing agreements, and all of the contracts that we use under those agreements will come to you pursuant to Directive 70.
I do have a question.
Sure.
I guess I'll turn to counsel. I thought that the statute said that the board had the sole authority to award, to approve these contracts.
Yeah, that's true. So I think in the past we've interpreted by resolution approving the interlocal contract that granted the authority to contract under the interlocal cooperation.
Oh, so when we're actually using it, that's when it comes to us.
Yeah, but probably the better practice, and that we're saying for consistency, what Clark is describing is that any contracts that are executed underneath the authority of the interlocal agreement will still come to the board for final.
Okay, all right, thank you. I misunderstood that.
So. And then one final little, a second resolution that we have to do because we couldn't bring this in under the interlocal resolution. When we use GSA contracts that are put in place by the federal government, we just need your authorization to use those. Typically, those are emergency response and disaster recovery. There are some technology products available to us on that. There's a limited subsection of federal contracts that we can use, and we're seeking your approval so that we can access those too.
Is this new?
No, this has been in, GSA contracts have been available for quite a while.
Okay.
I think we just have not taken the step to get authorization to use them. So it's always been a little of a roadblock for us.
Is that going to slow things up a lot?
I'm looking in the future for when things run more smoothly at the federal level and we can use those contracts. We haven't tried to use them under the current situation as to whether that.
Okay.
Slow down.
happy to take any questions. We do, as I said, have the resolutions. We get the next meeting on the
18th. Good.
I have no further. No, thank you.
These are great contracts. They really are a time saver. And, you know, if you don't like the price, you can work something another way. So I'm not quite following. So let's say we have a budget to buy vehicles approved by the commission. We're going to go buy a pickup truck on the state contract. If you just order the truck, and then when it's the invoice comes, the invoice goes on the consent agenda. Is that? That's what I'm not following. What the board's.
So what would happen in case of vehicles is there would be a budget that transportation would manage for replacing those vehicles. And so typically they're grouped together and it can be by five F-150s at a time or a couple of Lightnings, something like that. Before we placed the order and finalized the order with Ford and the state, we would come to you for approval to use that contract in that instance to buy those five vehicles. And then once we've gotten approval, then transportation goes in and completes that order with the Ford dealer who has that contract.
So we'd approve use of the contract every time the contract's used?
What you've done is we have approval to use the Washington State contracts. And then that gives us access to all of the contracts that the state has bid. And then when we use individual contracts to make actual purchases, we have to use approval for those individual purchases. So.
Yeah, you're not approving the use of the contract, you're approving the expenditure of district funds.
Okay.
That's why it's not.
It just seems unnecessary to do that. Maybe they can be very small.
But these are individual purchases required by the transmission that we have.
I understand the contracts too, but okay. Okay.
That's a good question.
Yeah. Any other questions? Thank you,
Clark. Next, we have Marie Morris, then, with a presentation on the Bonneville Power Administration Provider of Choice.
Surprise! Just wanted to jump in really quickly. Garrison Morris, Senior Manager of Power Supply. We've got a little bit of an unusual sequence today, out of our norm. So we're going to bring this briefing to you. You can see in this slide, we've provided several briefings on this contract, but we're also going to ask for a resolution to authorize the GM to execute this agreement today. That's unusual. We don't want to make it a habit, but there are some dynamics in the political environment that could introduce a risk to Bonneville contracts being paused. And we want to expedite our signature so that we can get ahead of that. So that is the driver of us acting in this way.
Only for clarification, could you elaborate what you meant to say with that? I mean, for the people that are listening, for transparency.
Just understand that there's some advocacy from different entities in the Pacific Northwest asking the Department of Energy to pause contract execution. We don't think that's likely, and Bonneville just announced some settlement proceedings that should take some of the edge off of some of those things. But in just an abundance of caution, we want to sign our contract as quickly as possible. And we've seen some of our regional peers like Tacoma Power and Eugene Water and Electric do the same. So we want to proceed just mitigating risk for our customers.
Thank you. Is there any rationale behind this?
Hi.
You don't have to answer that.
It's complicated. There's multiple negotiations going on with BPA at the moment. And so different parties are trying to gain leverage.
It is mainly around the residential exchange program.
Oh, okay.
And so they're looking for, any kind of leverage there. But, we just want to get our contract executed and we go for 2028 and beyond.
Okay.
Now on to the previously scheduled program.
Thank you, Garrison.
Great.
Good morning, commissioners. This is the real Marie Morrison. You can land this part in power supply. Well, Garrison really set me up very good here. Today, I want to talk about the contract background, which you already heard about. This is our fifth briefing about provider of choice. And also, I want to talk a little bit about the staff recommendation to sign the contract today. So you've heard about the contract four times before. This is our fifth time going to you about the provider of choice contract. Like Garrison said, there are still some risks related to the other related processes, specifically residential exchange. And we just want to really take you to the finish line today so that we can get that risk out of the way. To mitigate that risk, we're asking the commission today to sign the contract. As you heard from Garrison, there have been other utilities that have set it in stone with BPA. And so we're asking you to do the same thing for us and our customers. You've seen this slide before. It just shows you the share of BPA power in our power portfolio. It's really our largest resource, power resource in the portfolio. A 1% increase in BPA power translates to 0.5% increase in the rates that our customers pay. And the integrated resource plan is really, the planning behind that is really anchored around our BPA power product. So as you know, it's an important part of our resource strategy. For the provider of choice contract, you already know that this contract meets the priorities we have set for ourselves going into provider of choice. It is access to low-cost BPA power. It will meet our compliance requirements in terms of carbon, and it also provides us with sufficient capacity for when we need it. And also, an important thing is it aligns with our district strategic priorities to build a sustainable future for our communities. And one other important benefit to provider of choice is that it incentivizes the integration of non-federal resources and new technology. We have a new battery coming online next year, and we know that that battery will be helpful for us when it is coupled with provider of choice, because it is treated in a beneficial way in provider of choice. One of our priorities in provider of choice is to make sure that we have enough to supply our customers. And when the process started in the initial concept, we didn't really have that much allocation. But we engaged with BPA and other customers, and in the final analysis, we got more than we had expected. So the benefit of provider of choice in terms of that allocation is really the savings that we will get from this contract. We did the analysis, and the analysis shows that we will get approximately close to $350 million by signing this contract. Now, we also know that we're growing and we need to provide power that is beyond that low-cost tier one power. And the IRP is looking into that, looking into the least cost resource to serve our customers beyond that low-cost tier one power. And the provider of choice contract, like I already mentioned, treats the battery differently. Meaning the battery is not reducing our allocation in the new contract. So all in all, provider of choice is a good thing in terms of contract allocation.
So this is primarily linked to the fact that we didn't lose anything in terms of our allocation because of that. Is that what this is saying?
That's correct, Commissioner Olson. So the battery is not decrementing our BPA tier one tier.
So this is something I didn't quite understand. So our high water mark is 811 now. Okay. And we expect it'll go to 790.
That's correct.
And so is Bonneville going to do a calculation based on how are they resetting the high water mark?
So there's several components in resetting that contract high water mark allocation. There's a credit for conservation. There's a credit for new resources. And there's some other credits that are put into that contract high water mark allocation of each utility. And if you recall in previous briefings, the tier one system size is fixed. And so we knew that we won't get the 811. And so that allocation was calculated based on the information that other utilities submitted to BPA that includes conservation, new resources coming online, and several other things that contribute to that contract high watermark.
But that new contract at high watermark would be the same throughout the entire contract?
Sure. Okay,
very cool.
So in terms of carbon, which is another one of our priorities, we also know that the provider of choice will meet our needs in terms of compliance with state requirements. BPA Hydro will be counted towards our CETA requirements. And so we this contract would really get us to the finish line in terms of carbon. Now, we just changed to the load following product. We know that with that change, BPA will provide us with the capacity that we need. It will be BPA's obligation now to provide us with that capacity. And so this is another plus for the contract, rather, because we will no longer need to go to the market to provide for that capacity. And the contract also has a provision to credit customers that provide capacity to BPA. So those monetized credits, we expect the battery to provide those credits for us, but the calculation would be much later. But it's already guaranteed that the battery will be beneficial in terms of that capacity credit.
For how many years the contract will be?
It will be for 16 years. Now this, for cost, this is very important to us. The public rate design methodology will accompany the provider of choice contract. The PRDM is the methodology that goes hand in hand with provider of choice. The initial calculations from BPA show that we will have lower rates, but all else equal, we will have lower rates in provider of choice because of capacity cost savings that we will get from this new contract, which we are not getting right now in the current methodology. This chart just shows the trajectory that we're seeing when we sign the writer of choice contract, lower rates into the future. So to wrap all things up, the
provider of choice contract is really the least cost resource for us into the future. With the scale that we have right now, 780 average megawatts, and then a peak load of 1400, this is really the least cost resource out there. We also want to build the momentum that we have right now with the load following product, continue that momentum from today into the future. And like I already mentioned previously, a contract provides us with the assurance that we are serving our customers and it meets our priorities that we have set for ourselves 4 years ago or 3 years ago. So now we're asking the commission to approve the resolution for the general manager and his designee to sign the provider of choice.
Questions or concerns? This is back to us this afternoon.
So therefore, we're assuming that 780 is our ceiling with regard to the rate, the Bonneville rate tier one, and two is then will be on the peak load. Most of our peak load will come from two, level two.
When we
and have- I'm not clear, I guess. Our peak load, which is up to 1400, that difference will be primarily out of tier two, right? No, okay.
I think it's the average that counts for the year, right?
That's correct.
Can you please clarify for me?
Yeah. Just in case it's helpful, our actual contract high watermark or CHWM is not going to be determined until likely the summer of 2026. We forecast that's going to be about 790 to 795, but the process that Bonneville's going through right now is taking all utilities' weather normalized loads and feeding them into the contract high watermark model, verifying all the data, and then calibrating that with the different adjustments that Marie mentioned. So 790 to 795, that's where we think we'll be. That's an annual average load metric. For the load following product, what we love about it is that there is no cap on capacity. We do have to pay capacity charges based on how much we use, but there's no limit on that. Tier two is an energy product. So if we exceed our contract high watermark, we're eligible for it, but we're not obligated to take a tier two product. So a lot of what IRP looked at was what's the best mix of above high watermark load service options. And we're going to do more analysis in 2026 with the commission about those tier two options and what elections we want to make in the contract.
Thank you. I have a question.
Yes, Chris.
I'm quite confused, so I don't know, curious. When we talk about the rain mitigation costs, that sunset over time, and you talk about that, it's going to be less. So on another hand, we are talking about it to increase rates. And then and for here, you mentioned about the rain mitigation. So I'm a little confused in that because we are talking, I mean, since like other meetings about the increased rates.
Yeah. So this contract, again, just a reminder, this contract is from October 2028 through September 2044. So it's into the future. In terms of the risk mitigation slide that you're talking about, Commissioner, this risk mitigation cost is what it says there, that sunset over time. So in this contract, there is a provision to help other utilities transition from the current rate methodology
to the future rate methodology. And the way to do that is to provide some mitigation, some kind of subsidy for other utilities to be able to still buy the BPA product. So that mitigation, that sort of subsidy, will sunset over time, meaning it will get lower and lower over time. So that is also a driver for that cost savings that we're seeing. But really the bigger driver is the capacity cost savings that we're going to get from provider of choice through the rate design methodology. Thank you.
So you'd like to tag on to your question. So if we look at the green line for 26 and 27, that's the contract we're in now, and that's where our cost will be. But the 28, we expect them to drop slightly based on the new contract.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
No.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. And want a break? Or tips? I'm seeing headphones. It is 10:01. Let's come back at 10:10. 10:10, and we are back in session. What do you have next for us?
Next, we have Felicia Ning and an update on the 2026 poll attachment rates.
All right. Hi, I'm Felicia Ning, economist in the rates department. And with me in the audience, I have Beth Haskin from the joint use group, who's going to help me answer some of the tough questions that may come up. So for today, we have 2026 poll attachment rates. So the purpose of this presentation today is to share the new updated poll attachment rates, which, if they're approved, will go into effect on January 1st, 2026. And a couple of follow-up meetings, we'll have a public hearing on the 18th and then a vote on the December 2nd. So a bit of background on poll attachments. Currently, the district has just under 88,000 poll attachments, 29,000 or so are on district-owned polls, and the remaining 59,000 are on jointly-owned polls. In total, we are looking at about $2 million in revenue from poll attachments. And just as a reminder, last year we did approve a 5% rate increase. So that amounted to a $1.54 increase for attachments on district polls and 85 cents increase for those on joint polls.
I have a quick question. Are poll attachment numbers going up or not? I just noticed more and more undergrounding of fiber in a lot of areas. I'm wondering if the poll attachments are decreasing or increasing.
From what I saw last year, I think there's a slight increase, but I'll have Beth confirmed, yes. So here's a quick refresher on how we calculate the rate. Our methodology does follow the Washington State Code that was put in place back in 2008, and it's made up of two parts. The first half is the SEC telecom method, which is commonly known to benefit the attachers more because the formula only considers the usable space of the pole. So those would be the blue sections on the diagram here. The other half of the rate is known as the APPA shared cost method. And the largest difference there is that it's how the common space is treated. And the common space is the unusable space of the pole. And in this method, the cost of that space is equally allocated to all attachers rather than have the utility bear all the costs. Here's a couple of assumptions that we make at Snohomish that differs from the FCC and APPA standards. The first one has to do with the space occupied by the attachment. The standard assumption is to use 1 linear foot per attachment, but we at the district have a prior agreement with our attachers to use only half a linear foot to allow for more attachments. And that in turn helps reduce the attachment rate. The next one has to do with pole size. The standard assumption is to use 37.5 feet. We actually use 45 feet in our calculation because that's a better reflection of what we actually have out on the field. And that again helps reduce the attachment rate. The last one has to do with safety space. We actually do not factor in the safety space in our calculation. That's again due to a prior agreement that we have with our customers.
How long do those agreements last? Are they perpetual? This one on the safety thing came to my attention. Those old rates?
That is something that we've had for as long as I've done the rate, and it's just for the calculation itself, yeah.
Is it actually an agreement, or is it just a past practice we've been doing?
I'm not sure. Do you know the history of it? No.
They're probably embedded in our
code. You can try to find out if there's any history on that.
I just think before the next time this comes to us, it'd be interesting while we're doing it because we've all been done, or I don't know. We're making new agreements all the time with customers, actually. So,
yeah, that would be a big one to sell
to them. Yeah. That'd be a big one to take away. Okay, thank you. So the last one is, these are what the proposed rates look like. So for attachments on district poles, the rates will go from $32.58 to $35.40. And for those on joint poles, we'll go from $17.92 to $19.48. The increase is mainly attributed to our cost of poles, which we have seen go up by, approximately 5%. And the rise in our aging expenses by 17%, and also our maintenance costs by 13%. In total, we are expecting annual revenue to increase by 200.
Is this on top of the 2 million?
Yes, so there'll be an increase from, and just as we do every year, we notify our attachers in July about this potential rate increase. We haven't heard of any concerns so far. Here's how we compare to our...
Sorry, could you go back?
Sure.
So only for clarification, the annual revenue is it will be 212?
212, increase.
Increase, okay.
Here's how we compare to our neighboring utilities. The one I usually like to compare ourselves to is Seattle City Light, because they regularly update their rates, and they have both a joint and utility-owned rates. And as you can see, we're tracking right below them, as we usually do. Another one to note this year is Tacoma Power. They actually haven't made any rate adjustments in the last 5 years or so, so this is a more recent rate for them at $44. And up from what I believe was below $30. Right, and so next step for us is a public hearing, like I said, on the 18th, and then a vote on the 2nd. And if all goes to plan, these rates will go into effect on January 1st.
Great, thank you very much.
All right, thank you very much, Lucien. Up next, we have Christina Lineweber, and she's going to present on the cost of service analysis and preliminary rate design for 2026. And as we say, today we're going to be primarily going to focus on how we apply the rate adjustment in the different rate classes. So is that in the fixed or the energy charge? And really looking for a good discussion here with the mission and feedback as we move forward with that. So looking forward to the discussion.
Thank you, Jason. Good morning, commissioners. As Jason said, I'm here to discuss the ways that we can implement the scheduled 2026 rate adjustment. We will have a brief overview of what led us to this point and then jump pretty quickly into the actual potential rate designs. And this meeting is one of the series of meetings on rate designs that we started back in July, and we anticipate to continue through the end of this year. So to remind everyone how we got here, and also for the benefit of anyone who might be listening online, The first step in this process was to set the revenue requirement, which happens through the budget process. And from those discussions, the commission settled on a 2.5 system average rate increase. The second step of this discussion was to allocate that rate increase between the classes and decide what the total dollar amount that should be collected from each classes is. And we had a couple meetings on that and discussion on that. Here, as a reminder again, and for those who might be watching online, here are the 7 primary classes of the utility. And the residential class is by far our largest class and the one that contributes two-thirds of our retail revenue, approximately. And then we have a number of 2 smaller commercial classes and some industrial classes and then some special purpose classes. And it was recommended, we after having the commission's feedback, settled on the following recommendations for a 2026 recommendation, particularly to do a 2.8% rate increase for the residential class, and then smaller rate increases for most of the other classes, as was suggested by the cost of service. Now we come to the new materials for this meeting, which is to look at how we can actually implement those rate increases with prices per day, per month, or per kilowatt hour. And this is called the rate design phase of rate setting. The largest class, as I said, is the residential rate, so we will start there. We would like to propose to the commission an initial recommendation where we put all of the rate increase into the fixed daily charge. And those rate increases are listed here that would get us to that 8% increase for the overall class. This means that there's no change to the energy charge. That portion of the bill would remain the same. And the fixed dollar impact, so the number of cents per day, would be the same for all customers. 10 or 11 cents for most customers. The overwhelming majority of our customers are in those small and medium classes. Only about 600 to 700 about 650 customers are in the large class, and about 30 customers are in the extra large class.
I'm sorry. Could you put me an example for the large class?
So the large class is for those who have amp sizes of over 400 amps. That's very large. So maybe someone with an extremely large house, maybe somebody who has their garage full of power tools, maybe somebody with a heated swimming pool, those are going to be the kind of higher load classes. Also, when we implemented the fixed customer charge, we put all the existing customers on small and medium sizes, and we only upgrade them to the larger, extra large sizes if they're having new construction or new hookups or a substantial remodel that, you know, triggers all the permitting and stuff like that. So that's part of the reason between having such a small number of large and extra large customers. Those are not just customers that are using a lot, but the customers that have chosen to have a new connection or a significant remodel that brings them into these very high categories. Thank you.
With so few customers in those categories, is it worth having those categories? It doesn't seem like it would really tip the scale much, not like the small and medium.
You're correct that it's not a huge amount of difference if you know, change those amounts. It is nice to have a customer signal, especially if we're thinking about new construction or remodels. Hopefully customers are thinking about conservation and thinking about their usage on there. And it's good for us to have that information as well and keep track of that in our records so we understand how customers are using and what they're doing with their power.
And I'm just curious, what is the percentage of the small customers that we have or that we serve?
So about 35% of the customers are in that small category.
35, and for the medium?
65. Okay, thank you.
Any further questions?
So as you can see, particularly with those first two bars there that show our small or medium customer charges, we're really within the pack of utilities in the Pacific Northwest, our peer utilities as far as our customer charge. This idea of breaking out the customer charge by panel size is a relatively new idea. We're a little bit on the, one of the benefits of being a little bit later to implementing a customer charge is we're sort of implementing a more sophisticated customer charge than a lot of utilities that have very legacy customer charges. So we're actually getting some utilities copying us rather than the other way around as far as this idea. And so you can see it's a little, but that does make it a little hard to compare with other utilities since many of them do not have this average size basis. But as I said, the vast majority of our customers are in those two right-hand bars, which are within the regional specifications and peer utility norms for customer charges. And once again, just another way of looking at that same information is to see for example small or example medium customer how the energy charge under this proposal would remain unchanged and just that fixed daily amount would go up.
Before we go into the other categories, can we spend a little more time on residential? Can you go back a slide?
Yeah.
So, commissioners, I looked at this graphic, and, you know, I have been a proponent of adding to the fixed cost because it gives certainty to customers in how much the bill is going to cost. There's no guessing the bill is going to go up exactly 10 cents or 11 cents or whatever the increase is per day. But when I looked at this and I reflected how far the top three tiers bars were relative to our peers, I decided to go back to the workshop we had in 2019 and then what our final decision was. So for Commissioner Alfermano's knowledge or background, we didn't, and you can tell us, Commissioner Olson, how long, but for many, many years, we had no fixed charge. And the conversation at the time was about, we had years where we sold more power than we had budgeted. We actually got more revenue than we needed. For years that might have had mild weather and we sold less, we didn't satisfy our requirements for revenue. And so we were sort of putting ourselves at risk. At times we were under-collecting from customers and over-collecting from customers. So we talked about aligning that, and we did it over, I think, a five-year period. But when we did that, this chart, which only had one bar, surprisingly, because we were always talking about a four-bar rate, was down closer to where the small customer was. And we had a graphic at the time that there's sort of three levels of what we would put onto customers. And I can't remember what those are off the top of my head, but we sort of picked that lowest level and we were getting our feet wet. And so I think we've satisfied the challenge of over-collecting or under-collecting in gross from the residential customers largely. And so now we're down to, you know, what each class of customers cost. And I'm getting more concerned with our fixed cost. And I've actually have started to hear more and more about ratepayers about it. They're aware of it. That may be because I live in an area that doesn't have electric heat for the most part. And so you really notice it more when you don't use a lot of energy. And I've heard it from the solar customers. And so I'm wondering if we can jump ahead to the appendix and look at those three options you gave us and have a conversation, commissioners, about whether we should continue to raise the base charge or if we should consider putting the cost in the energy. This is back in the appendix of the presentation.
Yeah, did you have other questions on this?
I want us to consider whether we should stop increasing the base charge for a while, maybe until we get more clarification on what it's. So if you remember that workshop all those years ago, we looked at a plethora of different kinds of customers that had an extra garage or customers that all electric heat, gas heat, and we sort of got a broad sense of where we were headed and how much our change, which was to add a base charge, was going to impact each of those customers. And of course, some it impacted negatively and some it impacted positively. And so I'm concerned, and I'm responsible too, that we went way beyond what we had agreed to go beyond. And we've now and are proposing even higher fixed charges than we had ever planned on doing them. I think it's starting to impact customers.
Well, we certainly can't talk about, I'm not prepared today to have that conversation until I get a better understanding of the implications.
Yeah.
And I'm a little confused. I felt our analysis and our rationale behind going to this formula was pretty sound.
It was.
And I guess I need some help in terms of understanding the why we would change and the implications that it would have, because I'm not there yet. So, yeah. You know, I can't have, from my perspective, mm-hmm. a substantive conversation on it.
I'm with you, Commissioner Dalton. And besides that, well, I missed the workshop years ago.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a big window, and I try to catch up and I try to digest and process in my head and understand. So, yes, I need help to digest all this as well. So
we can come back and kind of refresh that conversation. And Commissioner Logan, the three classes back there, or not classes, but three things we kind of looked at in 2019 were the connection costs, and then, you know, connection costs and grid costs over, and then all fixed costs. So those are kind of the three levels we looked at for including in that, you know, fixed charge on the customer bill. And the commission elected to go with the connection costs, and where we're at today in the fixed charge is beyond that. So it's an excellent point. We have progressed beyond that, and I think it would be worth kind of a refresh conversation.
Yeah.
You know, do we think that's the right thing to do, or, you know, do we think that, you know, kind of shifting back to putting the increase in the energy charge is the right thing to do? So I think that's kind of the, you know, the nature of the conversation that we need to have there, and would certainly be
that's
looking.
That's the part I'm struggling with.
Yeah, and we'd be looking for guidance from the, you know, commission.
Yeah.
So what does this mean to our overall schedule, though, in terms of this is currently what this budget is based on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as far as getting the rate increase, you know.
Of course, that is down into, yeah, that yeah. is until quarter one.
April 1st of 2026. So we definitely have some time. The current plan, you know, was to start the hearing and then have another hearing next commission meeting and then approval at the first meeting in December. You know, so we have another meeting there between now and the end of the, well, we have another meeting there at the end of the year, you know, that we can
talk as well. And I think we can talk in the next meeting as well.
Yes. So as far as the budget and concerned and getting that 2.5 system average increase and getting the revenue that we need for the budget, that can go forward with any of the rate designs that we propose. So we can continue to come back to you with more information about the rate designs, as long as you're okay with those percentage increases being fixed. We can then create the rates to meet those percentages.
So we need to decide, we need to vote in December. So I want to do the dates, you know, I mean, in my head. So with all these presentations, we have to decide in December and then apply in April. So that's how it is.
If we need to, we can go into January to do the rate design, as long as you're comfortable with the percentage impacts. So as long as you're comfortable with this, back, so many slides back, as far as you're comfortable with these suggested increases, so we can raise that overall dollar revenue in the budget, then we can go into January if the commission so requires to do the rate design. This is the part that needs to be fixed to do the budget in December.
Well, this is to me, and I respect my fellow commissioners, they are more used here, but it's a really serious decision. And then we're talking about it, you know, we talk about all the people that we serve. And yes, I think it's gonna take time, at least for me, to do that and be ready. So, but I don't wanna speak for my fellow commissioners.
Yeah, I think what we're saying is green line, the 2026 recommendation.
Yes.
We can approve that in December with our budget. And if we haven't figured out how we say, for instance, the residential, how the 2.8 gets collected just in base charge or a combination of base charge and energy cost, that part can be done
a little bit later, yeah.
A little bit later.
And I'm fine with that, as long as the opportunity is provided to us to be briefed on the implications. And I would like to hear a recommendation at that time. And then we have that.
I feel in the same way.
Well, so we have a recommendation. This is the recommendation.
In terms of the design.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to call attention that his staff provided some alternates in the slide deck. I just want us to look at those first ones. You know, I know we're not going to make a decision.
Staff provided.
They're in the presentation. Yeah. I just wanted to talk about those because we don't typically talk about the appendix.
Hi there. So with any help, Peter Downer, senior manager of the Rates, Economics, Energy Risk Management Department, been working with Christina closely on this. Just wanted to say that, you know, one of the questions, if we were to sort of consider more deeply the sort of fixed rate trajectory that we might look at, is what goes into that fixed rate. And some of that discussion, I think, was at the 2019 presentation workshop. As Jason mentioned, talking about just what the connection fee is. There's other alternatives that other utilities can use to justify more or less fixed charge to sort of be allocated into that fixed charge component when it comes to the rate. You know, things like part of the distribution system or part of the semi-variable demand. And those are different options that are out there. So if we come back with a discussion around that, you know, it's really going to be a question back to yourselves is which one of these, you know, options are out there seem convincing to you as well on what could go into that rate. Other utilities, you know, they do it differently. So we can come back and sort of provide some more context and really sort of refresh what was discussed in 2019. But I just wanted to let you know that's kind of what it would be talking about. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you, commissioners. Would you like me to continue to the commercial rates now, or would you like further discussion of the residential rate?
You're willing to look at those alternatives during the time?
In the appendix.
Okay, well, take us to that slide. All right, commissioners. So if you go down to the appendix, here we go. On slide 36, on page 36 of the appendix, we have a brief reminder of the benefits and also the reasons that we think about the fixed charge or not. So the fixed charge can support electrification because it reduces that fuel cost for electricity. It also helps us with cost causation since we have so many fixed charges in the fixed costs in utility systems. And it also can limit the dollar impact of rate increases, particularly for high users, because it's whatever amount per day. Of course, the energy charge, there's a reason utilities use energy charges as well. It does send a conservation signal by making more prices for higher users. And then if individuals have very low usage, then they will have a proportionally lower bill. And so it benefits those low users.
I don't understand how the change in the energy charge benefits the low users. Because the low users are, their bill is dominated by a higher percentage by the fixed cost.
Yes, but if they're, the more that's in the energy charge compared to the fixed charge. So if we were to say get rid of the fixed charge and go back to all energy again, then that would be beneficial to the low users. Well, if we increase.
I understand. Okay.
Yeah.
I
any other questions?
It's
kind of
backwards.
Okay. So there were some requests about what kind of parameters we're talking about when we talk about, well, should we put it in the energy charge or the fixed charge? So this is an example of what happens if we put all of that 2.8% increase in the energy charge. It would involve increasing the energy rate by about 0.33%. And so that's the kind of magnitude that we're talking about. And how that impacts people's bills will very much depend on how much they use. So it'll impact high users more. And that means, in practicality, it affects often customers with electric heat or sometimes customers that are low income if they have either electric heat or cannot access conservation. So that's the magnitude we're discussing.
But do we know if it disproportionately impacts our income qualified customers? I mean,
we're looking at that right now. We actually had a query running overnight that still isn't done to pull the data from our limited income customers in our program.
Thank you.
And then to show you what a mixed sort of half and half kind of scenario would look like, we could put a small increase in the fixed charge and the remainder in the energy charge. So this is, you know, an equal percentage basis in both portions. So again, to just show you the kind of orders of magnitude that we're discussing when we discuss these decisions.
Thank you. Any questions on these questions?
Not at this point.
No.
I'll save my questions for upcoming presentation.
But I'm thinking before we leave this, if we should let them know the kinds of questions we have about. I've got a couple of questions. One is, where we are relative to those initial three levels that we looked at, which is the lowest level. More information about how it impacts different customers, income qualified, non, those electric heat, those with not. Those are my two chief questions. I really have to question this. I don't know why. For some reason, it drives me crazy that we're going to have a large, extra large rate that's higher than Opalco, which is a utility full of subsea cables and low density homes. And I know we only have 30 customers, but I just wonder if there's a virtue, if we really need that, if we really need those two top ones. But I do understand they come to us with more cost.
Yeah. And these decisions, do we have a room for community input? I mean, the customers that we serve, they send some comments, opinions regarding these too, because they are the ones they use, the energy that we provide, right? So I'm just curious how important could be.
Yeah, that's why we do these meetings. So we've had a series of four meetings. So we want to encourage all customers to come, especially the public hearings, where we'll take public comment, whether it's in writing to the commission or in person at our meetings or virtually. But we've had, although not required by law, we have a series of both rates and budget meetings to make sure that the public has access to this process.
And so far, how many participants do we have? Does somebody know? Well, I think the people that listen these conversations and these meetings, they should, and they, you know, I mean, to send whatever comments that they have, because when we take the decision later on, that's different comments, and when we invite to participate, we have these meetings for that reason. So, thank you.
Well, and this is sort of why I bring this up, because this issue really impacts all customers differently. I understand the equation of HOSA and the issue going to perfect fairness to the extent we can amongst the classes. But I think it'd be behoove us to understand where we already are, how we're impacting customers. But maybe we've gone far enough for a while. So do you have any other comments, Commissioner Olson, things you'd like to see when this comes back and we have a
And I believe you've already said this, the rationale that we used in terms of method that we're using and the split between risk and energy, revisiting that October 19th or whatever it was session. Yeah.
Yes, 2019. So we can definitely bring forward the historical rationales and
guidance. We need to revisit those.
Set.
Yeah,
I agree.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing me around.
For what?
For humoring me.
I didn't intend to.
Thank you for all the feedback.
I appreciate the conversation.
In the question, so we can bring that back and be prepared.
Yes, please. And please, if you think of additional questions on this topic, if you could send them in, that's super helpful. You can go ahead and incorporate them into the presentation.
Clarify, we're moving forward with our current schedule and the rate structures that have been based upon the model. We're moving forward with our process, with our budget, and that our conversations can happen after the first of the year.
Yes, if required.
Yeah, if required.
I would like to ask, so besides the decision that we take, we are going to still allocation for people that you need to apply for reduce, I mean.
Yes, this will not have any impact on the low income.
Okay, thank you.
And if you have the ability to present to us before the next time, or before the budget, that would be best. Oh, I mean, I think I'm not asking for us to go to an extensive analysis. I would just like us to consider the question and so.
Yeah,
we get data, we can look at it and make a decision whether it's a decision I like or not, and move forward.
Yeah, we'll do our best to keep those two things aligned and bring the information and the pros and cons of, you know, how we see it from a just a utility staff perspective.
Yeah, today and into the future.
Yeah, yep. And I think there's lots of good things to discuss there.
Yeah.
Well, you made my morning.
I should have brought a vegetable platter.
All right.
All right, thank you.
So we'll see if there's equal excitement about the commercial rates here. The first rate here to discuss, to show you is the small general rate. So this is for commercial, commercial customers that are under, that are not large enough to qualify for a demand rate. And so we are again proposing to put it, all of the change into the base charge with similar rationale as for the residential customers.
They just have a substantially lower energy cost.
Yeah, they just have lower energy cost. And then for the medium service, general service customers, so these are the customers that are larger. So this can be any, this can be a large church, maybe one of those multi-campus churches, maybe a large grocery store, maybe even a light manufacturing kind of place that has some of those higher peak demands. And so we are proposing to split it between the fixed and the demand charge elements of the rate. And so this will bring our base charge up to where we really think it should be, and then a little higher in the demand charge, which would also be in alignment with the cost of service.
So the demand charge is the peak consumption for a specific amount of time,
yes,
within a month?
Yes.
Okay.
Then we are not, we would, as was discussed earlier when we talked about the percentage increases for the various classes, the legacy time of use is not scheduled to have any rate increase, so it will remain the same. The special continuous service, these are, for example, the energy to the pole attachments that Felician just discussed. They just, they don't just live on the pole, but they actually take energy from us. And so again, continuing with our theme of putting the costs in the base charge.
So things on the pole that require mm-hmm. energy, are these just smaller devices?
There's
are cell towers, right?
No,
cell
no. No, these are the little attachments. Okay. They're frequently unmetered. And so we build them just based, because they're constant usage, just based on the size. And then we're moving to the industrial rate designs. Our large primary service has a minimum charge, which we think is appropriate, but really for such a large user, it isn't necessarily binding usually. And so we suggest dividing this rate increase between the demand and energy charges. And for our customers here, this is what the typical customer impacts would be for each of the customers in those classes based on their average monthly usage. So they are very similarly impacted by this choice of rate design. We also have on our books a large service load. We do not currently have any customers on this load, but we do have it. It's based on a proportion of the current industrial service load. It's more of an indicative pricing, but we don't have any, as I said, any customers on it, so I can't show you any sample bills, but this is what we would put into the rate book.
Would this be data centers, or would it be data centers would be another category?
Most data centers are so large that they would actually be on this. Maybe an itsy bitsy data center.
Oh.
A baby data center. There we go. And here is our famous rate comparison, with 2024 being the most recent year for which we have data for all our comparators.
For which rate is this? Which class?
This is average of all classes. So this next steps is probably not exactly our next steps now that the commission has requested some additional data, but we will attempt to come to you hopefully by the next meeting, knock on wood, as soon as possible with additional information. And we will try our best to get everything done before the end of this year. But as I said, if it has to go into January, we can make that happen. And then finally, we do have the appendix, which shows all our lighting rates, which are just percent increases based on before. So unless you have any particular questions about all of those, I can let you read those at your leisure.
Any questions on other items?
No.
Any other questions?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you for the great presentation. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Christina. That's it for all of our presentations this morning.
Okay, next, item five, our CEO General Manager report. You have a report for us today?
Yes, I have a few things to share with you. First, from our Human Resources Department, we received 37 applications from leaders across the district for external leadership development opportunities. Six individuals were selected to participate in programs including NWPPA's Fuel Program, Willamette's Utility Management Certificate, WEI's Utility Business Essentials, WEI's Business Acumen for Emerging Leaders, and University of Idaho's Energy Executive Course.
Were these courses audited by our staff in terms of their value?
Yes, yeah, we've had folks attend these for
quite
a few years. And, yeah, I attended the Business Acumen course back in 2016. And yeah, excellent courses. And really kind of a neat program that we can do for our future leaders. And
used to have to fight tooth and nail to get some.
Yeah, we did. Okay, one other thing from our Human Resources Department. The November Gratitude Thanksgiving Challenge runs from November 5th through the 25th. It's a fun way to build core strength while practicing gratitude. Planking supports better posture and reduces back pain. And taking time to reflect on what we're grateful for can boost happiness and lower stress. Yeah, sounds exciting.
I
stop by and chain, but not together.
That's lowering stress.
You show us too.
Yeah. I expect to see a lot of people planking right in the office too. From our Energy Resources Department, the district was, and Aaron touched on this earlier, the district was awarded the National Hydro Association Outstanding Stewards of America's Waters Award. The award was given to the PUD based on its Spada Lake Reservoir hydrology model improvements. The PUD developed two new hydrologic models to support Jackson Hydro operations by enhancing reservoir elevation forecasting at Spada Lake Reservoir, improving generation planning and FERC license compliance. These scenario-based tools allow staff to simulate inflow and outflow conditions, enabling more accurate reservoir management and better informed generation decisions. With greater forecasting confidence and precision, staff can safely operate closer to spill elevation, allowing the reservoir to top off ahead of summer and strengthen water supply for customers and communities. Another update, so there is a potential for a EPA power surcharge of approximately 2% that could take effect starting December 1st. My understanding is that 2% is the highest the surcharge will be. The last three lower water years have depleted EPA's power financial reserves, and EPA could potentially trigger this surcharge. It's going to be discussed more at the next quarterly business review meeting, the BPA quarterly business review, which is November 13th. So we'll know more then. Like I said, my understanding is the kind of the ceiling would be 2% and, you know, could be nothing. So we'll wait a bit more on that.
And our budget didn't identify them.
No.
Didn't anticipate.
Yeah. We'd have to look at it, you know, once we know that final number. If it was something, you know, I guess we could pass it through, do it
That's right. We pass through. Yeah. So for what term?
I'm
for just this right period, or
I would think it would just be until the end of the EPA water year.
Okay.
But yeah, I'm not sure of that. Yeah, so maybe not as exciting news on that one.
Oh, yes to me.
Oh, good, not good news. Okay, one more update here on the oil spill at Jackson. The generation crew and environmental have done an outstanding job responding and following the district's spill prevention control and countermeasure plan. I've been out there and witnessed it really doing an outstanding job. A majority of the oil has now been cleaned up. Cleanup will continue, and today the generation group will begin to formulate a plan to make repairs to the unit, that was unit two, that experienced the leak. As a part of the response, the district notified the Washington State Department of Ecology and continues to provide ecology periodic updates. Any questions on that one?
No, but thank you for that. So our generation is lower out of Jackson.
So unit one is still generating as well as unit three and four.
Oh, okay.
And this is useful. Yeah, it's just unit two that is out, and we've actually really been trying to keep generation up. That keeps the river level up a little bit, and that allows a good majority of that oil to be trapped in the tail race. Little baffle that comes down, and you know the water's sitting on top of the oil, so by keeping that river level up a little bit, it trapped that oil behind that baffle or vault there. Yeah. So that made it, you know, wasn't escaping, could be cleaned up and sucked out of there. So
are there any potentials for fines?
So there is, you know, I expect we'll see a penalty. You know, and that's basically the way that's calculated is the amount of oil that, you know, leaked. And then they look at the amount of oil that you cleaned up in the first 24 hours. And then they subtract those two things. And then that is what a penalty is assessed on.
But we moved pretty quickly.
We did. Yeah. I'm just super impressed with the crew and environmental. Ecology was notified right away. They were out on site. Substation also assisted that first night. And yeah, our crew noticed it right away. Immediately called in more folks and began to, you know, put the room out there. And that all happened before I started out, just saw a sheen there. And then they got right on it. And then, you know, the leak got a little worse there. But thankfully, they had the you know, boom and already going there to help with that.
Are our oil booster wandering? Yep. Fish that are in the stream currently?
Yeah, they've been out monitoring that, walking the river and looking for anything out there.
And how did that happen?
So basically, there's a supply line that supplies hydraulic fluid to what we call the needle. And it's what sprays water on, called a Pelton wheel, which is like a bunch of buckets, water sprays on them. And then that causes the Pelton wheel to spin, spins a shaft, and then that's how the electricity is generated. So that supply line basically just split the weld there. And it's, I mean, it's strong steel, you know, but it's been 40 years, and we think it's just fatigue over time. And it happened right after the power outage out there, which is a pretty, you know, turbulent time down there, especially in the tail race where that line is. So.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, customer and energy services, I have two updates there. On October 9th, customer and energy services hosted 42 different community agencies from across our service territory for a community coalition lunch. The event was focused on identifying challenges facing vulnerable populations and sparked discussions on ways agencies could work together to reduce program barriers. Of particular note was the diversity of partners, which included government agencies, charitable organizations, churches, school district staff, the Tulalip tribe, and district employees. In follow-up to the recent presentation on the Clean Fuels Program, we are excited to announce that the Electric Pathways for Transportation grant application soft launches on November 3rd, yesterday. The grant is funded by the Washington Clean Fuel Standard and is available to non-residential customers for electrical transportation projects. Applications will be accepted until March 31st of 2026, and funds will be awarded by June 30th, 2026.
So the applications are generated by Snowbud. Is that correct, or is it the entity?
So let's see, non-residential customers for electrical transportation projects. So I think it's customers that then submit those by March 31st.
Okay, is that right?
I don't know if there's anyone who must speak to that, but I believe that's the case.
That's your report.
That's it.
All right. Any questions for Jason about the report? Of happiness and breast relief?
Yeah.
Well, I said.
You should.
Well, probably for me. Oh, when you say.
Definitely for me. No, my back needs to.
I could understand it if you were saying
that. No, not even. Next is item six, our public hearing. 6A, continuing the 2026 proposed budget hearing. I will now read and read a public hearing on the 2026 proposed budget. We have Sarah Vaughn, budget superstar, who will provide a presentation and discussion.
You guys are getting close to being done with me for the year. Well, we've had lots of conversations about electric, and today we're going to be switching to water. So I'm going to be kicking off a brief budget presentation, and then I'll be handing it off to Christina, who's going to be talking about rates and sort of things. So I'm going to go over some highlights, some sources and uses of funds. We'll take a look at the five-year forecast and reserves, and then the revenue requirement, which again will lead into our COSLA discussion with Christina. So you're going to hear from both of us today. We're going to talk about some of the cost pressures that the water utility has been facing. We've had some pretty significant capital infrastructure needs coming, higher operating maintenance pressures, inflation, just as we see on the electric side, and as well as growing shared services costs from electric. So what you'll see today is we're going to talk about some of the projects that are in there, some of the rate increases and bond issues that we have as placeholders. So just a brief overview of our water system. Got about 24,000 customers in our service territory. We have 9 different water systems. Similar like we show about electric, it's kind of fun to just talk about all of the assets that by the water utility that they have to maintain. 416 miles of pipeline, 16 reservoirs, 19 pump stations, 4 treatment plants, 2,500 hydrants, and 24,000 meters. So just similar, just a lot of assets that are out there in the community that have to be maintained. Looking at the people, 2026 budget has 40 FTE. 5 of them are time limited, 35 are regular. And you can see it's a little more union than non-union. Switching to, let's look at some dollars here. So if we look at sources of funding, $36.8 million in 2026 is the budget. You can see about half of it is coming from our water retail sales. We're planning on using about $9.3 million of the general facilities charges funds to help fund specific capital projects, which we'll briefly talk about. We're planning on using about $6.6 million in bond funds to fund some capital projects. We also have wholesale water sales, and these are sales to some of our cities, Arlington, Snohomish, Granite Falls. We're planning on using about $710,000 of the revenue fund, and then we've got other miscellaneous revenues to help balance it all out. On the opposite side, how are we using that fund? How are we spending the money? About half is on our capital budget this year. And you can see if you look at the little box on the side, we show that it's we have $11.9 million in capital, which is pretty substantial. But we have different funding sources, which we've mentioned, which are paying for it. So about 5.6 million of it is coming from rates. O&M is the next largest piece, about 26%. We have a slide that'll talk a little bit about some of the major programs in there. Purchased water, you were briefed, I believe, last meeting or before about the city of Everett and the cost increases we've been seeing there. And of course, we have the principal and interest and taxes that we pay. A little bit deeper into that purchased water, this just shows that not all of our water comes from the city of Everett. We do have our own treatment plant in Lake Stevens that we produce water. We, of course, use that as much as we can to reduce our reliance on the city of Everett water. Some major O&M projects. So shared services, about $4 million. These are the costs that the electric system that are, the water pays for these services from the electric system. We've got our source treatment costs. So pumping and chemicals, that sort of thing. All of the maintenance on the mains. That are general facilities, structural, so landscaping contracts, just kind of some of the miscellaneous items that they pay for. And then pumping costs, all the things that I've been learning about recently about they do over at the beginning of the looking at switching to capital. So these projects are some of the ones that we're planning to use bond funds for. So we've got two major main replacement projects of about $2.3 million. Finishing up the deployment of AMI for the water meters, about $3.5 million. We've got a corrosion control, about $805,000, and then some continuation of work on Orm Beach well treatments, $117,000. So these are just a few of the projects we're looking at using bond funds for.
I have a question.
Yes.
With the replacement of aging lines, water lines, someplace else, I don't see that listed here.
That's revenue, correct? These two main replace, the two main replacement projects. They include that. Right.
And the first line, the
first
main, the first
purple.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Next, looking at our general facilities charges funded projects. The construction of a new reservoir on Bourne Road, a pretty substantial project, $8.7 million. Design work on another new reservoir at Warren Beach, $250,000, and then the Granite Falls booster pump station,
$350,000. So, if I'm looking back at that map, we only have four customers up by the Warren Road area, is that correct?
I'm going to defer to the
plus the city of Arlington.
I'm going to defer to somebody in the water system then. Talk about that one.
Morning, Christina Art, manager out of the water utility. Yeah, out at Bourne Road, that's actually going to help with redundancy and resiliency and beating Granite Falls as well as safe. Yes,
okay.
It's more than those.
Okay, good.
And there's also a possible plat that's actually going out there as well. So.
Thank you.
Taking a look at some of the capital expenditures that will likely be funded from rates. We've got some seismic evaluation retrofits on some reservoir, got some safety improvements that we need to do. Vehicle replacements tend to be rate funded. And then we've got some pressure reducing valve fault lids. So just a variety of things that we'll be using rates for. Let's take a look at the 5-year water forecast. So you'll hear a little bit more from Christina about the rate increases. It is pretty low, relatively flat forecast as far as consumption goes. There are a series of proposed rate increases starting in 2026 that you'll hear more about. On purchased water, you can see there's pretty substantial growth in the numbers. A lot of that, I mean, most of that has to do with the intended rate increases from the city of Everett. We just discussed and you just approved a pass-through of 2.5 in 2026. Operation and maintenance, you'll see some growth there. That's inflation on most of our costs. Their numbers might vary slightly depending on the number, the amount of capital we have might impact that number a little bit. In capital, you can see 2026 is a pretty large capital year, but you can see still a decent amount of capital expenditures in the plan. We are penciling in some bond issues, $11 million in 2026 and $7 million in 2029 to help fund some of the capital projects.
So if I understand this correctly, the rate increase for 2026 would be 5.75 plus 2.5?
That's correct. So just looking at reserves, as unrestricted reserves, similar to the electric side, we've got the operating reserve and the contingency reserve. As I mentioned earlier, we are planning on using a little bit of the operating reserve to fund operations in 2026. So we'll see a little bit of a decline there. On the restricted reserves, three reserves. The project reserve is a combination of the GFC fund and the bond reserves, and we are expecting to use some funds there. Last but not least, we showed this when we were talking about electric, but you'll hear a little bit more about this in the next presentation, but you can see that there definitely has been some use of the water reserves over the last few years, combination of some flat rate increases for a few years, and then higher operating costs. So we'll talk a little bit about the plan to restore back to our requirement. And as a lead into the COSA, the calculation to get us to our revenue requirement. So we've talked about all these pieces. So you can see our operating expenses. We have about $15 million in revenue funded operating expenses. Our capital rate requirements, $5.6 million, as we discussed earlier. There are a few other revenues that we have. We have our wholesale revenues, other operating revenues, and our reserve use. When you put all the pieces together and you subtract out what we're expected to get at current rates, it's about $1 million deficit, which leads us into the rate increase that will be discussed at the next presentation. So relatively brief, but you'll get a deeper dive in just a few moments. Next meeting, November 18th, we'll be coming back to talk about any proposed changes to the budgets we may have, based on new information that we've received, and we'll be requesting approval on December 2nd. What I have for you today, unless there's any questions, I'll pass.
Any questions, Commissioner, on the water budget?
No,
okay.
Other than having to give them to me.
Yeah.
It's not a question, it's a comment.
Are there any comments from the public regarding the proposed budget? Please raise your hand. And questions or comments from us. I'll call for a motion to continue the public hearing in the 2026 proposed budget.
So they have
I move the public hearing on the 2026 proposed budget to be continued Tuesday, November 18, 2025 at 9 a.m. 2320 California Street in Everett. And I will call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously. Next, we have item 6B. I'm going to open a public hearing for the proposed revision of the district's general rate, retail rates for water utility services. Allow me to public hearing on the proposed revision. The district's general retail rate for water services. Christina Arndt here, who has facilitated presentation and discussion. Is this a presentation we've already seen?
No, we are opening a public hearing. We're doing it a little differently this year.
Okay.
We're doing it in line with the budget instead of after.
Sure.
So it's kind of a continuation, similar to what Electric did. So today we're just providing our proposed 2026 water general retail rate adjustment. There's no action today. Today, I'll briefly go through a little bit of background, touch on some of the highlights that Sarah has already shared with you around the capital from the 2026 budget, which is impacting these rates, some of the summary of our findings and our retail rate recommendation. With the background, every year we do actually do the revenue requirement review, which is needing to be taken so that we avoid deficiencies in any of our capital or operating next year and future year, in order to maintain fiscal targets, such as our days cash on hand, our debt reserve, our debt targets, any assumptions that we make with our coverages, and then also avoid the risk of any of our capital investments and maintenance. So in the 2026 budget, some of the highlights and rate impacts, as were mentioned, supply chain issues, inflation, which we are seeing with electric, any of the known tariffs. We particularly see tariffs on steel right now, regulatory requirements, and some low system growth. So we also have some labor cost impacts, including the shared services. We have two new FTEs in 2026, and then the continued increase in administrative costs. We also have our enhanced days cash on hand policy target that we are working on a trajectory to get to within multi-year. Then we have our bond funded projects, which are about 31% of our capital, and about 55% of our capital is the GFC or general facilities fund. We are proposing currently a 5.75% water general retail rate adjustment. We are looking at about $11 million in 2026 for a bond issuance, as well as we're estimating our days cash on hand to be about 107 with a target of 100.
I have a question regarding the two new FTEs in 2026 and what area are going to be?
Yeah, so the two new FTEs are going to be primarily focused on our operations core function area. And in the overall operating strategy, they're going to be looking at operational trends, our leak detection program that we're going to be standing up in our mains, pressure monitoring, system monitoring, distribution, a lot of trending.
Thank you.
And when I saw this increase, it's, you've held constant for a number of years.
We did. Yeah, 2018 was one of the first years after a few years of no rate increases. We were doing our initial revenue requirement, COSA, we were bringing that into play. So we did not do any. 2018, we had a very low 1.8% rate increase. 2019, up until 2022, we had no rate increases at all. And then we again started off with very low, small incremental, trying to build back up. We have been seeing a lot more cost issues on maintaining our infrastructure, which is primarily ground, which is driving a lot of this right now.
Learning experience.
Yes.
Thank you for that question. I really appreciate it because I was like thinking about it like, for how long they needed to be. So does that help
yeah.
All the information? Yes. Thank you.
This graphic was just to indicate primarily our single family customers, which are about 95% of our customer base, with the 5.75% increase, as well as the 2.5% state of our pass through that we just approved, how it compares to the inflation that we have been seeing. We are currently in 2026 still under inflation and will be that way out until 2028. So Christina did a great job with the electric COSA and explaining how we go through this, but there are the three typical steps, the revenue requirement, cost of service, and the design of the rates and how you apply those. For water, we specifically focus on the revenue requirement and cost of service. As for the rate design, the cost goes across both the base charge and the consumption charge. There's no difference there. So, and we are not proposing any change for that. So we, again, focus just on the revenue requirement and cost of service. As we went through, we have these rate strategy guidelines in our forecast. So again, repeating a little bit, but $11 million in debt issuance in 26 with another $7 million in 29. We put on here just to indicate where we are going to be with our days cash on hand with our assumed water general retail rate adjustments in 26 out through 2030.
What is our ultimate goal for cash, days cash on hand?
Yeah, right now, one day's cash on hand is about $41,000-$42,000 to operate the water utility.
No, but some goals were set for.
Yeah, and we're trying to get to that 150 days.
So,
yeah, 150 days is our ultimate target. We're trying to get there. And in order to get to 150 by 2027, we would have to see some very significant rate increases over a two-year period.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the cost reductions that we went ahead and moved forward with for 2026 in order to essentially push off some of that rate impact to our customers so that it didn't negatively impact them, but also still maintain our reliability and resiliency to operate. We're no longer purchasing a 7-yard dump truck. We are replacing the box on a 12-yard dump truck instead of replacing the entire thing. We work a lot with our transportation and fleet department. They do an excellent job maintaining our vehicles so that we can push that out and have them be in service for a bit longer than their intended useful life. It actually extended it for us. So they've done a great job with that. So we work really closely with them.
I do have some questions on the fleet items. It costs more to keep something that's outlived its useful life in terms of maintenance.
It can.
So, well, the decision was necessary to, the decision not to purchase next year was made primarily to keep the cost down.
Yeah.
Overall budget cost.
Yeah, because our vehicles are
term. How many miles do these things have on them?
I don't have that number in my head right now. I do know that one of the items that we have in our budget for 2026 is a new hydrobacter truck, which is about $815,000 of that $1
million.
Okay. That one, there's a lot of safety around that one. There's a lot of reliability around that one. That one we did determine could not be pushed. But in working with transportation, like I said, we were able to determine that the 12-yard dump truck, the chassis, has a lot of life still in it with minimal maintenance. And the only thing that truly needed to be replaced was the box because they were fixing that quite a bit. And that was costing us a lot of money. So instead of buying an entire new dump truck, we were able to save and only spend a little bit of money to fix what we needed it.
The longer you have to do more maintenance on an existing vehicle that's 12 years old.
Yes.
That's all I needed to.
I want to say thank you for doing the deep dive. And it's just challenging work to try to figure out where to cut in light of the rate increase. So I appreciate it.
So again, this is just showing the revenue requirement that Sarah presented earlier. And based on that revenue requirement, we did land on a 5.75% proposed rate increase.
So we're still under what we need.
Yes. I mean, to be able to hit some of our ultimate targets. Yes. Yes. So in January 2026, the recommendation would be to have the 5.75 across all of our rate classes. Based on our COSA, every single rate class, which we only have a few, are all within that plus or minus 5% of paying their equitable fair share. This table is just a forecasted rate schedule. We currently show it as a monthly customer charge. That amount would be about 99 cents per day, changing to a water daily base charge. And then this is a graphic, again, focusing on the single family, as they're about 95% of our customer base. Their average user, a monthly bill would be about $61.97, which is $3.33 higher than previous. Yes. And in a rate comparison with other utilities in the area, we are still about middle of the road with our rates. system utilities are partnering. So as of right now for 2026, our general retail rate recommendation is a 5.75 effective January 1st, and it would be applied equally for all classes of service.
How many customers do we have?
We have just shy of 24,000. Thank you. And as for next steps, I'd be coming back in on the 18th for another public hearing and any additional questions. And then December 2nd, we would look to take action on this as well as the budget. And then January 1st would be when the rate would actually take effect. What I have.
Thank you. So are there any questions from the public regarding the proposed revision to the district's general rate for water utility services? Please raise your hand. Seeing no hands up. I will call for a motion to continue the proposed revision to the district's general rate retail rates for water utility services.
I move the public hearing on the proposed revision to the district general retail rates for water utility services be continued to Tuesday, November 18, 2025 at 9 a.m. at 2320 California Street in Everett.
I will call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Motion passed unanimously. So it's 11:30. Let's take a short break. And come back at 11:35. It is 11:35 and we are back in session. Next, we have item 7, public hearing in action. 7A, consideration of a resolution declaring certain properties interests of the district and a portion of certain real estate, real property, tax parcel number 27042900301600, situated in the city of Edmonds, Washington, to be surplus and authorizing transfer of said property interest to Edmonds Village, LLC. I will call for a motion.
I move approval.
I'll now convene a public meeting. We have Willie Barnes available to answer any questions. Any questions from the public regarding this resolution? Please raise your hand. No. Commissioners, do you have any questions or comments?
I have no questions. I have no questions other than reading parcel number. I thought you were both actually military days. I'm sorry.
Pilot days, yeah.
I could do that next time.
All right. I will now close the public hearing and I'll call for a vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Motion passed unanimously. Next, item 7B, consideration of a resolution amending the district's water retail rates and charges to repeal the monthly customer charge and adopt a daily base charge. I'll call for a motion.
I move approval.
Now, if we need a public hearing, we have Christina available to answer any questions or provide the prior specification if necessary. Are there any comments from the public regarding this item? Please raise your hand. Commissioners, do you have any questions or comments?
I have none.
We'll brief thoroughly on this. We'll close the public hearing and I will call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously. Next, items for individual consideration. Agenda item 8A, consideration of a motion accepting the third quarter 2025 financial conditions and activities monitor report. I'll call for a motion.
I move acceptance.
We have Sean Hunstock here to provide us a presentation. Bill, say good morning.
Good morning, commissioners. Thank you. I am Sean Hunstock, senior manager, controller, and auditor for the district. I will, in the interest of time, go through the presentation fairly quickly, but certainly if you have questions, please feel free to let me know. And I will get this eventually. There we go. So on the electric and generation side then, You may recall with the last quarterly presentation, we changed the format of this a bit. It used to show current year to prior year. One of the things that that did was it consistently presented an anomaly comparing this year to 24 when we had the results of the MLK weekend. So we changed the quarterly report with the last presentation to include budget to actuals instead. So I'm happy to report that net income for the electric and generation system is ahead of budget. It's also ahead of prior year, currently a $75 billion positive net income. On the operating revenue side, operating revenue side, again, ahead of budget, that is on the retail side, and we'll look at this a little bit more quickly in another slide, a combination of an increase in kilowatt hours sold and the rate increase. Operating expenses, purchase power is behind budget, and O&M slightly ahead of budget.
So with the increase in net income, I'm not sure how capital impacts days of cash on hand. Does this have a big impact too?
I may defer to Treasury for that. My understanding is that would typically result in a it would go out of the operating fund, but then reimbursed by the project reserve. So the money then would go back into the net income. But the project reserve would obviously go down as we spent those capital projects if it's bond funded.
Thank you.
Oops, too fast. So again, just some quick highlights on that previous slide. Again, net income is above budget. We have had some increase in the kilowatt hours sold and an increase in the rate as well. Operating revenue is again increased compared to budget. Wholesale revenue is down. There's a larger supply, which decreases the rate for that wholesale power and a lower demand at the same time. So just a decrease compared to budget for wholesale revenue. Operating expenses. Those are the differences there, as you note on the previous slide, are not significant. A decrease in purchase power offset by a small increase in O&M, but otherwise not a lot of movement in the costs. And capital expenditures are below budget. So there's some detail later in your packet in the budget, the treasury, budget treasury and project status report later in your packet that has individual product or project information for budget and expenses. So and look there for the detail, especially compared to budget. A couple notable projects. These are inception to date expenditures, not necessarily this year. So North County office, $53 million, Connect Up for electric, $17.2 million, and the Camino Island substation, $10.4 million. Again, just looking at the retail sales then, we do see an increase this year so far through September. Again, that's an increase, and you'll see that on one of the operating indicator slides as well. A small increase in the kilowatt hours sold as well as a rate increase. Other revenues are ahead of budget as well. We did have the HERS grant that came in this year that was not budgeted for, and a few other miscellaneous changes, but overall, again, an overall increase of $14 million in revenue compared to budget. Not a lot of change on the megawatt hours build here. We obviously see the only significant difference here is the wholesale sales. Again, this slide in particular is not budget. It's current year to prior year. And we do have that anomaly at the very bottom with, we ended up having more wholesale sales last year, in large part due to the impact of the weather and especially the MLK weekend that caused that variance in the prior year. But otherwise, no significant variances this year. Operating expenses, again, I mentioned earlier, the purchase power is below budget.
Operating expenditures are a little ahead of budget. So again, overall, not significant change in total for the total operating expenses. On the megawatt hours, the power supply, this is on the cost side, not a large difference in the BPA product. This is again through September, so not reflective of the product switch. This is still under the block slice methodology, and again, not a significant difference there in the output, and insignificant difference in on the cost there as well. Lower market purchases, again, because we, compared to 24, we just needed fewer megawatt hours purchased from the open market. Again, that was really indicative of the weather in 24 and the impact of the MLK weekend. So again, with the market purchases, 25 compared to 24, a big difference, but again, that outlier in 24. Financial condition indicators. This is the first quarter where you see that we're 1 year removed from the combining of the reserve funds. So the operating reserve fund did go up from 215 million to 231. The project reserve reflects the impact of the bond issuance offset by some bond funded expenditures. Current ratio has gone up, which you would expect to see with more cash in the fund, especially the operating reserve fund. Near the bottom, then this reflects the upgrade of our rating from Fitch from AA minus to AA. Other operating indicators, I mentioned earlier the small increase in retail megawatt hours sold. You see that there, and the decrease in the wholesale megawatt hours sold. Again, reflective of the weather conditions that happened in 24 that didn't obviously happen again this year so far. One thing I will mention on the net write-offs, the 24 number for the amount, 214,000 for the year-to-date through September of 24. That is artificially low because of the utility assistance, the $200 bill credit, and other things that were received in the past. So one thing I'll mention, we went back and looked at the pre-COVID numbers because we've had other forms of utility assistance during that time as well. So the pre-COVID number then through September of 2019 was 1.9 million. So we're a bit under that right now, but we are back to the pre-COVID number in terms of net write-offs. And customer connections has gone up a bit now, just over 385,000. So on the water system, again, good news here is the net operating income is ahead of budget. The capital expenditures are below budget. So again, good reflection on the operating income and reserves for the water system, and net income, again, ahead of budget, and total operating revenue down just a bit, but the operating expenditures are down as well. That's a combination of O&M and the purchased water costs. Some of that being reflective of the sales as well, obviously. So, and the capital expenditures are behind budget as well.
The retail sales down because the weather, it's less yard watering?
Right, that would be my assumption.
Depending on so the boss.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
The boss said yes. And then, but that is reflected on another slide.
Oh,
yeah, I think it's the second to last slide. So we'll get there. It'll show the difference in the CCF sold. So again, just some quick highlights from the water system income statement. The net income is up, again, driven by lower
operating expenses and purchase water retail sales are slightly under budget, better weather conditions this year compared to prior year. You know, purchase water, low budget, that's in part due to demand, but also due to scheduled City of Everett filtration plant maintenance shutdowns. Capital expenditures are again below budget. And again, later in the packet for this meeting, there's some information on project-specific expenses compared to budget. For some inception to date costs, I'll just mention briefly the Warm Beach treatment plant, $2.9 million, kayak reservoir, $3 million, and connect up so far per water, $3 million. Some financial indicators for water, the operating reserve is up, contingency reserve. For the same, we do see a decrease in the project reserve as we've spent down some of those bond funds from a recent bond offering. Current ratio has increased and improved as well, and pretty consistent with the other operating indicators. Also, well above the debt service ratio target of, I believe, 1.7, so we're still quite a bit higher than that. Some other operating indicators then. This is retail, but it's a combination of the residential and other categories of customers. So up slightly for, these are actuals, not budget, up slightly compared to the prior year. The CCFs sold, or purchased water, excuse me, up a little bit as well. And the connections have gone up by 119. So as Christina mentioned earlier, we're just under 24,000 customers at this point. And that's about as fast as I've gone through this. So any questions?
That's the one.
I have none. He always makes it so very clear.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any comments from the public regarding the monitoring report? Raise your hand. No hands up. Any more questions from commissioners? I will call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries unanimously. Next up is 8B, consideration of resolution authorizing the CEO general manager designee to execute the provider of choice contract number 26PS25083 between the Public Utility District Number 1 of Snohomish County and the Bonneville Power Administration. I'll call for a motion.
I move approval.
Marie Morrison is available to answer any questions regarding the resolution. Are there any comments from the public regarding the resolution? You raise your hand. See any hands up? Commissioners, any further questions or comments?
I have none.
Still fresh in our minds from earlier this morning. I will call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Motion carries. It's a good piece of work. 8C, consideration of a resolution authorizing the Chief Executive Officer / General Manager of Public Utility District Number 1 of Snohomish County to execute a settlement agreement regarding certain litigation with Inertia Energy and Machine Works Incorporated, Stevens McCarthy, Lancaster LLC, and Wesco Distribution Incorporated. I'll call for the motion.
I move approval.
Colin Willenbrock is available to answer any questions regarding the resolution. Are there any comments from the public regarding this resolution? Please raise your hand. No hands raised. Are there any questions or comments, commissioners?
No.
None. I'll call for the vote. All in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Motion carries unanimously. Next is on 9A, commission report. Are there any reports, commissioners?
I have none.
Got a quick report, Energy Northwest. So recently, the board of directors, including myself, gave unanimous conditional approval. And the project has been named Cascade Advanced Nuclear Facility. So
What will next come with this is final approval, and final approval will require each of the member utilities boards, so the three of us for SNOPUD, to vote on it.
And then we would have presentation at that time. And
yes, in fact, we're probably going to have one early next year.
Okay.
To start the conversation. Energy Northwest tentatively is looking for approval in May. They've got a lot of things they've got to do with that to meet the conditions.
So was the committee approved with conditions then?
What we approved were the conditional approval really approved the conditions, the questions they have to answer.
Okay.
To come back.
Okay. All right.
And that's the part I've mentioned several times. Yes. Jofina has been hugely involved with and really changed the conversation. And Joe and Colin and I had some good updates from some of the professionals before the vote.
Right.
To understand some more of the risk. Yeah.
Okay. Great.
Yeah. And then, you know, there's a chance that we will start seeing some questions from the public because, you know, the information is out there and people have different feelings about nuclear.
Right.
So yeah. We may be getting some public comment. Let you know. Okay. Next up is 9B, our commission events calendar. Are there any changes to the events calendar?
Don't have any questions on what we're showing here. I just had a question on our legislative reports. I don't remember what
the under the governance calendar. This is the event calendar.
Okay. I have a question on the governance calendar.
Okay. The only change is I have sent RSVP'd to the Economic Alliance legislative kickoff, so that will appeal on their next time.
So would I.
Okay, good. Any other changes to the event calendar? Okay. Then we have 9C, September 2025 District Performance Dashboard. Any questions, comments about the dashboard?
I have
none. I had a question, and it's on the next item. Okay. Next, we have 9D, our budget forecast and major project status report for September. Sarah Bond is available to answer any questions regarding the report. Are there any questions, commissioners? Say, I had one, but I got it answered in the previous building.
Yeah, there are a couple of instances where I picked up that we've identified for a variety of reasons that don't have anything to do with what we do, like that they're being moved, the specific item is being moved into 2026 due to an availability of material or delays in receiving material. There was some others too.
Any questions,
Commissioner? No, I haven't.
Yeah, the only thing with capital, it's expert more than maybe this is a conversation, larger conversation for other times. I don't, when we start out with a project that maybe multiple years, I don't really understand, say, if it's going to be a $25 million project, what is it all to believe? And when we delay capital, we have more inflation. And I understand we can only do so much. And I'm just sort of curious. Yeah, that's maybe the conversation for another time.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. However, in some instances with these multi-year programs, there can be delays. We're experiencing delay in getting the materials
right
that we need to do the work.
Yeah. Well, and for System Connect, we are tracking that. It's one of the things that's reported to us.
Yeah, that's right.
And, it continues to be phenomenal that considering the years and the delay in getting the meters and all the inflation that's happened, they were still on track to, at this point, not even using our contingency.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I just wonder, it's sort of a conversation about internal controls.
Well, and you're referring to multi-year.
Yeah.
Okay.
If we say a project's going to be $25 million.
Over a certain number.
What does it end up being?
Yeah, essentially across the life of the project. How does it compare to our original estimate?
Yeah.
Are those things done internal?
I would say for the larger projects, what we tend to monitor more closely is the year-to-year budget. But it's a good point.
But for the larger projects.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If that is something that the board would like more visibility into for larger projects, that's something that we could certainly provide.
Well, I wouldn't commit to that yet.
Yeah.
The board identifies what we define as.
Yeah.
And we could have a conversation
yeah.
on that.
Good. There are no questions on the budget other than my ramblings. 9E, consideration of a resolution establishing the regular meeting dates of the commission for the year 2026. I'll call for a motion.
I move approval.
Allison is available to answer any questions regarding the resolution. Are there any comments from the public regarding the resolution and our meeting dates for next year? Please raise your hand. Commissioners, do you have any questions or comments?
I have none.
I want to thank Allison. It took some wrangling to get the change a couple of years ago with the timing of AEPA and
right.
FWPPA. It took some wrangling to try to get two meetings in every month, and I appreciate the extra work. Okay. No more questions. I'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Motion passed unanimously. Next, governance planning calendar 10A. Are there any changes to the government?
Always my question now regarding our legislative reports. And maybe there, I don't see anyone that in the audience that can answer that. At one point, did we say we wanted quarterly reports? We identified a specific time frame. And we haven't had one in a while, and we've got another session coming up. And so I'd like to know when we'll start receiving these reports for the next session. But can you remember the sequence?
I don't think I can just join. I don't think there was actually something decided. We used to get them every
on that one?
Yeah, we used to get them every other week.
During session.
When we were not in session, we would just get a monthly report. I will circle back with Kim.
Yeah, because I've talked about when we were not in session, that it was
one
year
a month.
That we wouldn't
yeah.
be getting, we didn't need to have unless there was something that should be brought to our attention.
So were you looking at having them more frequently?
No.
Okay, so maybe once
not before. Not during or directly after. Oh, did I?
I'm
simply
for advocacy is having at least once a month or something. Okay.
Oh, you thought that was okay?
No.
Okay. Nor do I.
I guess what's the preference that the cadence that you guys would like to have legislative reports and I can have a discussion.
Well,
with
I
think you're just asking the question is what
did
what,
we set a sequence?
I don't remember.
There was nothing decided.
There was nothing decided. Well, I don't know, unless there's some specific reason in between, the before and after, which we do pick up and have them every meeting or every other meeting.
It looks like Kim's joined the meeting and she has her hand raised, so I'll let her in.
Okay, all right, thank you.
Good afternoon, Kim.
I'm not a co-host again since I rejoined. If somebody else can allow her in the meeting.
Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Wonderful. Kim Johnston,
Chief Government Relations and Strategy Officer. This is a topic that my team has been grappling with a bit because of the pace of changes and rapid news cycles and information that is coming from all levels of government. You will continue to get your state session legislative reports on the same cadence, and we are tossing ideas around about how to best keep you updated on relevant information outside of that state session report that you all get. So if you can be just a little bit patient, we've been talking a lot about it, and I'll have a proposal or at least some options for you to choose from. But I think the report that we've done in the past is not going to fit the current day and age.
All right, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any questions for Kim? Thank you, Kim.
Thank you.
Is there any further business coming before the board today? Hearing none and seeing none, it is 12:04 and our meeting is adjourned.